Welcome to Gemara Markings. Today's shiur is Vav Kama Daf Kuf Beis. Don't forget to click on the Daf option in order to view a specially marked Daf Gemara for today's shiur. If you are not fully familiar with our Gemara marking system and wish to benefit from its great rewards, it is essential that you study all of the introductory material accessed by clicking on the Learn the System option provided on the sidebar of our homepage, and then go to option 2. If you're already partially familiar, you will benefit by clicking on the brief 4-minute introduction that is available here. Being that our system is a visual approach to the Daf Gemara, it is recommended that you print out the marked Daf before the shiur. If you wish to be in touch with us, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. Today's shiur begins in the middle of Daf Kuf Beis. If you prefer, you may count 23 lines from the top. The Dibur HaMaschil is from the Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Im HaShevach, and in the Mishnah we saw that if you hired someone to do a job and he performed differently than you expected, you asked for something to be dyed black and he dyed it red or vice versa, Rabbi Yehuda's approach was one of Knas, where the worker gets the short end of the deal. Namely, if the increase in value was greater than the expenses, the owner gets his improved material and simply pays the expenses. And if the expenses were greater than the improvement, the owner pays the value of the improvement and gets his item, gets his dyed wool. As we continue in the Gemara, you'll notice there's a simen. It's interesting that in the last couple of dapim, Tzadi Tes Omid Beis, Kuf Omid Aleph, and here we're at Kuf Beis Omid Aleph, the Gemara has had simonim, which are abbreviations that help you to remember certain points that will be featured in the Gemara. In this case, the simen is used to identify the names in the upcoming incident. Before we continue with the Gemara, though, let us glance in our margin where we have a Nosei topic heading, which reads as follows: HaGemara Mevareres. The Gemara will analyze. Loma Hoyotzorich Rav Huna. Why was it necessary for Rav Huna Lifsoik Kishnei Tanoim to issue a ruling like two different Tanoim regarding two different topics? Number one, Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha, Rav Huna ruled like Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha beinyan gvias chayvis migoyim lifnei chagom. The first topic has little connection; it has basically no substantive subject-wise connection to our Gemara, other than the fact that it's Rav Huna issuing the rulings. Rav Yeshua ben Korcha deals with the issue of collecting debts or paying off debts to idol worshippers right before their holidays. There's a certain element of joy involved in paying off a debt, receiving money or clearing away debts that you may have that may, the joy just mentioned may bring the idol worshipper to thank his idol on his holiday. That is problematic. Nevertheless, we have a special ruling here on the part of Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha that when it comes to an oral loan, a loan that's not recorded in a document, you're allowed to receive payment from them before their holidays. Even though, as we said, there's a source of joy on the part of the idol worshipper who knows that he paid off his debts. And the issue is dealt with at much greater length in Maseches Avodah Zarah, hence it's not important for us to dwell on it right here. The only issue being that in the case that an idol worshipper experiences joy before his holiday, we're fearful that he's going to thank his idol on the holiday, and a Jew should not be responsible for a Gentile's source of pleasure resulting in his thanking the idol that he worships. The second point, which is relevant to our general sugya, is the ruling of Rav Huna like Kerab Yehuda, the Mishnah Seinu. like Rabbi Yehuda of our Mishnah, the Chol HaMeshana Yodo El HaTachtona, as we explained a bit earlier, that he who changes from the instructions that he received, so his hand literally is underneath, meaning he gets the lesser end, the worse part of the deal. Now the Gemara. Yosef Rav Yosef, Achorei de Rabbi Abba, Kamei de Ravuna. Rav Yosef was seated behind Rabbi Abba, and in front of them was Rav Huna. The little squiggle underlines that you see, we've highlighted the letters Samach, Beis, and Nun. That is what the simen, the memory device that we indicated before, was highlighting. The Yosef Rav Huna v'kom Rav Huna was seated, and he said, number one, halacha k'Rabbi Yishu ben Karcha. The halacha will follow Rabbi Yishu ben Karcha that we'll see shortly. Halacha k'Rabbi Yehuda. Two rulings. Upon hearing these rulings, Ahadrinu Rav Yosef le'ape Omar. The expression Ahadrinu Rav Yosef le'ape is an expression you see from time to time in the Shas. Literally, it means, in this case, Rav Yosef turned his head away. It's an expression of discontent. Instead of confronting, and oftentimes if you have a man of great respect, of great authority, you don't want to contradict him or confront him head on. Nevertheless, at the same time, you don't want to show your agreement with what he says. So this phenomenon takes place, this turning away of the head. So that's what Rav Yosef did. And what was bothering Rav Yosef? You'll note we have a long question. In order to appreciate what was bothering Rav Yosef, we have to go through all of these lines. So the Gemara says, as in explaining Rav Yosef's problem, Bishlamo Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha Itzrich. I understand the need for ruling like Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha. Salka Daita Chamina, without Rav Huna, I would have thought Yachid v'Rabbi Malachi k'Rabbi. When you have a disagreement between an individual versus a majority, the halacha, the ruling will most often go like the majority. Komash Malon Halacha Rabbi k'Yachid. So Rav Huna, in ruling like Rabbi Yishuv ben Karcha, says that in this case we will follow the opinion of the individual over the majority. And within the brackets that you see, you have the background where Rabbi Yishuv ben Karcha appears stating his opinion, which is at odds with the Rabbonon. Skipping the brackets for a moment, you see we continue, Elo halacha k'Rabbi Yehuda lomali. We said, I understand why Rav Huna rules like Rabbi Yishuv ben Karcha. Otherwise, without Rav Huna, I would have thought we follow the Rabbonon. So Rav Huna tells us we follow Rabbi Yishuv ben Karcha in the matter contained within the brackets. Elam halacha Rabbi Yehuda lamali. What is there? What need is there for Rav Huna to rule like Rabbi Yehuda? It would seem obvious that we follow Rabbi Yehuda for reasons that the Gemara will say as we would go on. But we did skip a few lines. Let's go back over the skip lines. It was necessary for Rav Huna to tell us the halacha goes like Rabbi Yishuv ben Karcha. And now in the brackets, Rabbi Yishuv ben Karcha, mahi, what is the issue that Rabbi Yishuv ben Karcha dealt with? Desanya. Rabbi Yishuv ben Karcha omer, milveh bishtar ein nifroin mehen. A loan recorded in a document. You're not allowed to collect the debt the idol worshiper owes you before his holiday. Again, we explained earlier, because when he pays off the debt, he has a feeling of relief, of pleasure and joy. He will go and thank his idol for my accepting the payment of his debt. And the Jew should not be responsible for that. Milval peh, on the other hand, nifroyin mehen, a loan that's not recorded in a document. It's oral, so that in order to collect such a loan, I have to rely on his goodness, on his trustworthiness, that he'll pay it up. So that kind of loan, if you have an opportunity to collect it, nifroyin mehen, you can receive and accept payment of it. But neishu kematzil miyodon, because it's like saving something from their hands that otherwise you'll end up losing out on. So as we said, you have a chance to collect it, take advantage of it. Otherwise, you're going to lose out. The Rabbonon, they happen to disagree. And they say it's usur to pay them loans due to them, nor collect from them loans that they owe you before their holiday, regardless of what kind of loan, written or oral. Ella, we go on in the Gemara. Ella, halacha k'Rabbi Yehuda lomali. What was the necessity of Rav Huna to rule like Rabbi Yehuda? Rabbi Yehuda, we mentioned, appeared in our Mishnah, where the one who changes, one who's Mishana means he changes from what he was supposed to do, he gets the lesser end of the deal. Machlokes v'acharkach stam hi. The issue is stated as a machlokes. We saw in our Mishnah between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Meir said that the worker acquires it through shinui, and he simply pays the owner the value of the raw material that he received initially. And Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. So we have a machlokes in our Mishnah. V'acharkach stam means it's followed by another Mishnah later on, which features the opinion of Reb Yehuda in an unqualified fashion, without any name attached to that opinion. And when you have a particular point of view presented in a nameless fashion, we call that stam. And stam is an expression of something authoritative. And there's a rule. U'machloikes v'acharkach stam halacha k'stam. That's the rule. So we have a rule anyway. And the question then is, what do I need Rav Huna's ruling for? Now, you'll notice that we have a number of lines, once again, in brackets. The reason for the brackets is that the basic problem has been stated. Within the brackets, you have all of the background necessary for understanding this point that it's a machlokes v'achakas tam. So the Gemara will show you the sources that reflect that. But the question has been raised. It's finished. The question being, what do I need Rav Huna's ruling for when I have a standard rule of psak? Namely, when you have a machlokes followed by a stam, we rule like the stam, and the stam reflects the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda anyway. And now we go through the background. You'll notice we have a triangle marking on the side. We have a mivneh structural note. Havlotas, Bovakama, and Bovametzia. These are the names of Masechtas. We're learning Maseches tractate Bovakama. There's a next tractate. It's called Bovametzia. And you'll see that we have a the use of a squiggle underline will follow after these sources are presented, which will enable us to follow the speaker in a give and take structure of Gemara. So now we continue with the Gemara with all of the background information. Machlokes b'Bavakama. The machlokes that we saw in Bavakama is our Mishnah. We'll just read through this frame section. There's no need to explain it again. You hired someone with Zboya Loi Adam v'tzavoy Shachar. He changed Shachar v'tzavoy Adam. Rabbi Meir Omer Noisein Lo Demet Zimro. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Im Hashevach Yeser Al Yitzia Noisein Lo Es Yitzia. What do you see from Rabbi Yehuda? That the worker gets the lesser amount. And we call that Mishane, Yodo ala tachtona. The one who changes, so he has he gets the lesser amount. That's the machlokes that we saw in our Mishnah. Ustam, Bebova Metzia, in the next tractate. You see a stam Mishnah reflecting Rabbi Yehuda's opinion. This not call hamishana, anyone who changes. He received instructions to do something and he did differently. Yodai ala tachtona, he gets the lesser amount. The call hachoizer boy yodai ala tachtona. This second point is the main point, the relevant point for this Tanaic source where it appears in Bava Metzia. I emphasize that in anticipation of the Gemara here a little bit later. So there are two rulings in this particular Mishnah from Bava Metzia. One is he who changes from what he was supposed to do, he who does differently, and workers who back out in the middle of a job. How do we deal with them? So we say regarding them also, Yodo ala tachtona, they get the lesser end of the deal. We're not elaborating on that point here. That's discussed in Bava Metzia. What's the point for us? We see in Bava Metzia a nameless Mishnah that presents the opinion of Rabbi Huda. So without Rav Huna, I would know anyway that we rule like Rabbi Yehuda. What's the need then for Rav Huna to rule explicitly like Rabbi Yehuda? The Gemara answers, Rav Huna itzrich. As far as Rav Huna is concerned, it's necessary for him to say halacha like Rabbi Yehuda. Saka daita chamina, I would have thought, ein seder l'mishnah, that Mishnayos don't have order to them. And if they don't have any order, so then it could be that ustam v'achakach machlokesi, that really the stam preceded our Mishnah, and if that's the case, the ruling would not be like Rabbi Yehuda. So I wouldn't know. For Rav Yosef, who was upset with Rav Huna, he says, if that's your thinking, ihachi kol machloikes v'achakach stam, neimo ein seder l'mishnah, ustam v'achakach machlokes hi. There's a rule that says machlokes v'achakach stam, and we rule like the stam, but according to your mindset, the rule has no meaning. Anytime you see a machlokes followed by a stam, it might be that there's no real order, and it's actually the reversed. How then can you ever have a rule to rely on that says machlokes v'achakach stam? We rule like the stam. Rav Huna, what's his response to that? Doesn't he acknowledge that there's in fact a rule, that there is order? Rav Huna says ki lo amrinon ein seder l'mishnah. Note, there's a double negative in this. He says, when do we deny order to Mishnayos? Or I should say, when is it that we deny the lack of order of Mishnayos? Maybe in simpler terms we could say, when is there order to Mishnayos? Bechada Masechta. In one tractate. Within one tractate, if in an earlier part of the tractate you find a machlokes, and then later in the tractate you find one of the opinions stated in an unqualified, nameless fashion, then we say that the order is the determining factor, and you would have a machlokas followed by a stam. Avol betrei masechtes amrinon. But when you have two tractates, like Bava Kama, another tractate, Bava Metzia, amrinon, we then will say, ein seder l'mishnah. We'll say that there's no order to Mishnayos. If there's no order to Mishnayos, so I don't really know if the stam followed the machlokas. It might be the other way around. I need, therefore, a ruling on the topic, a specific ruling. I don't have a rule to go by. So as far as Rav Huna is concerned, the stam and the machlokas appearing in two different tractates. So as far as Rav Huna says, I don't know. I wouldn't know how to rule if I didn't have a specific ruling to follow Rabbi Yehuda. Therefore, Rav Huna paskins explicitly like Rabbi Yehuda. Rav Yosef, who disagreed with Rav Huna, he says, "Kula nezikin chado masechtehi." Nezikin is an expression, is a name of a masechta that encompasses, in effect, all three tractates, Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, Bava Basra. Some people refer to it in the shorthand, the Bavas. Bava, in plural, Bavos. Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, Bava Basra. These are three sub-tractates. They're all part of one tractate. Since they're all part of one tractate, the machlokis in Bava Kama is followed by the Stam in Bava Metzia. There is an order within one tractate. Rav Huna happened to disagree on that point, and he viewed them as separate tractates. What Rav Yosef looks at as one big tractate, Rav Huna viewed as three separate tractates. Another reason for Rav Yosef being upset is because the Stam ruling, like Rav Yehuda, appeared in an unexpected place. We mentioned earlier that the source in Bava Metzia, where Rav Yehuda's opinion was stated, Kol HaMishana Yod Al Tachtona, appeared essentially out of context. The context of that Mishnah was dealing with workers that back out. Why was the workers that back out, let's say, in midday, in the middle of a job? Backing out from a job is a different problem than someone who completes a job in a changed way from that which he was ordered to do. So why is that issue included in the case of workers backing out? So, what's it doing? What it's doing there is simply because it is a very authoritative ruling, so it's stated. And Rav Yosef was very impressed by that. And therefore, there is no need for any further Amoraic ruling for something that to him was so obviously the halacha. Now, we'll read that in the Gemara. The boyasemo mishum de katoni lo gabi hilchisa psikta. Kol hamishane yodoi al hatachtoino, v'chol hachoizer bo yodo al hatachtoino. Those were two halachas, and as we said, the first halacha is really out of context, and yet it's stated. Therefore, it's there to show me that is an authoritative ruling. Let's look at Rashi toward the end of the Rashi column. V'iboy esemo, hach stamo, the stam featured in Bava Metzia, vade iker. Who? It's certainly a mainstay of halacha. It's taught there in Bava Metzia along with formal halachic rulings. It has no other reason for being there. There's no relevance to the topic over there in Bava Metzia. It's taught there only to accompany formal rulings, final rulings in Kol HaChozer Boi, together with the halacha of workers that are that back out in the middle of their job. Shelo Nechlak Odom Aleim. Those are points that no one argued. No one argues over the issue of Kol HaChozer Boi. Likewise, the ruling of Kol HaMishane Yod Al HaTachton is also a solid final halachic ruling, and that's what impressed Rav Yosef, making Rav Huna's ruling essentially redundant, extra, unnecessary. Tanu Rabbanan Hanosein Mos L'Shlucho. We continue at the top of Omid Beis. One who gave money to his agent, likach lo chitim velokach mehem sorim. He asked someone to buy wheat, and he instead bought barley. Now, there's a main point that you don't see in the words of this source. Rashi adds them. The arrangement here is that they will share in the profits, so that someone wants to conduct commercial activity in grains, he gives money to his agent, buy for me wheat. The agent doesn't cooperate. He doesn't do accordingly. He buys barley instead, and he'll, as the story would go on, it's here in shorthand, but he'll then sell the barley and make a profit, and the expectation is that they would share in the profits. Another case, Sorim Velokach Mehemchi, gave the worker, the agent, money to buy barley, and he bought something else. He bought wheat. Tanya Chada, Im Pichasu, Pichasu Loi. One source says, if there's loss, it's the agent's loss. If there's profit, it's the agent's profit. There's no sharing. V'tani chada, another source says, im pichasu pichasalo. If he experiences any loss, he alone, the agent alone, must absorb the loss. V'mosiru, osiru l'emta. If there is profit, they will share in the profits. So, what are we to conclude regarding the presence of these two sources? You see diamonds, and on the side of the Gemara under our Nosei / Mivneh heading, the diamond appears. These are gishos, these are approaches. Hasbira machlokes tanoim binyan shliach lemachzischar, an agent who was sent to make a purchase and eventually split in the profits. Shishina, he changed the lokach dvorim achirim, and he bought other items other than that which he was instructed to buy. Ubecholzos hirviach, and nevertheless there was profit. In our markings, in the source that we read, you can see we dashed underline hosiru lo and hosiru leamsa. When there's profit, so there's a seeming disagreement between these two sources. We continue in the Gemara. Omar of Yochanan lo kashya. There's no contradiction between the sources. Ha Rabbi Meir v'ha Rabbi Yuda. The two sources simply reflect two different Tanaic opinions. Ha Rabbi Meir damar shinui kaina. Source number one reflects Rabbi Yuda, who says that when someone is requested to do one thing and he does something else, he was mishane, the shinui, the fact that he changed, acquires it for him alone. And source number two, v'ha Rabbi Yuda d'amar shinui einu kaina. Shinui, even though a change took place, that doesn't entitle the one who changed to become the owner of it. And therefore, if there are profits, so they will split the profits. If there's loss, so the original owner of the money can say, listen, you know, I didn't send you on a mission to cause me a loss. If of course he differed from what he was supposed to do, so he alone, the agent, bears the loss. Maskif lo Rabbi Elazar. Mi mai. Rabbi Elazar asks, who is to say, like you said, Rabbi Yochanan, Dilma ad kan lo koma Rabbi Meir? It might be that up till now we know Rabbi Meir to say that shinui kaina ela b'midi dechazi le legufei. That's when it comes to something that is fit for you personally. Rashi on the third line from the top says legufei. The wool that was given for dyeing purposes, so the worker can use the wool for himself. The safsal he was hired to make a chair, and the worker changed and made a bench. The worker can benefit from the bench. He can benefit from these items, from the changed item himself. So there, Rabbi Meir will say, shinui kaina, the shinu that he made entitles him to acquire it. Avol, we continue in the Gemara, avol l'schira, when it comes to merchandise that is acquired for profit purposes, for business purposes, lo amar, Rabbi Meir wouldn't say, shinui kaina. The Rashi on the fourth line from the top says, "Avalischira, bechol midi diikar ravocha." In any matter that has profit to it, nicha lei, he's happy with it. V'chio siru lav shinuihu, and where there's a profit is a profit. It doesn't constitute a change. The agent was sent out on a mission in general terms, he was sent out on a mission for prophet purposes. Does it make a difference how the prophet comes to be? So that it's not likely that Shinui would be grounds for acquisition on the part of the agent alone. Elo Amar Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar presents now his approach to resolving the two sources. Ha v'ha Rabbi Meir. Both sources are in accordance with Rabbi Meir. V'lo kashya. Kan la'achila, kan l'schira. Source 1 that speaks about the increase in value being beneficial to the agent alone, that's where the money was given for non-commercial purposes. It was gone, go buy for me, let us say, wheat. And he sent the money for buying wheat for his own eating purposes. And the agent went and bought barley. If there's some profit, some increase in value in that barley, the agent keeps it. Kan l'schora, source number 2, that spoke about sharing in the profits, that's where the item that was to be purchased with the monies was an item that was going to be used in schora, in merchandising, in transactions, in profiteering. And there, we say, the profit is split. And the fact that a change was made doesn't entitle the agent to keep all of the profit for himself. The Gemara, as it goes on, raises a question, but the question goes back to Rabbi Yochanan's version of Rabbi Yehuda. Before we go into the Gemara text, there's a structural note that we have to introduce the Gemara. Stage 1 of this Gemara will have a comment, Mochaku Allah b'marava. Literally, it means in Eretz Yisrael they laughed at something. In other words, a question is raised on their part. A question from Eretz Yisrael on something that was said. In stage 2 of the Gemara, triangles will appear, and at stage 2, there's a Nisayon Lahakshis Al-Machku Allah b'marava. Where the triangle points up, there'll be an attempt to ask on the questioners. Stage 3, you'll see an inverted triangle. Nisayon lidchais akushya umechazek esdvorov midine hektish. There will be an attempt then to reject the question, and that would thereby reinstate the opposition from Eretz Yisrael. And in stage 3, you'll see him, in this case Rabbi Yavo, trying to strengthen his point of view from laws regarding Hekdesh. Lomar degam Hekdesh mevusas al shlichus. That Hekdesh is also based on shlichus. What we just said, I must say, is abstract, is a little vague, because we haven't seen the actual comment to which this is relevant. But structurally, what we're trying to demonstrate is the Marava introduces a question, there's an attempt to reject the question, then Rabbi Yavo reinstates the question. He, in effect, reinstates the Machlokes Marava, and the details, of course, will be in the Gemara itself. There's more by way of structure that we'll try to point out later as we get into the sugya further. Before we continue with the Gemara text, let's try to introduce the issue outside. Above, we saw Rabbi Yochanan resolve the two Tanaic sources that we saw, the second and third lines from the top of this daf, by saying that source number 2 was authored by Rabbi Yehuda, who said, Shinui eino kine. there, in other words, there is a change here, but that doesn't entitle the one who changed to be the sole owner, the sole acquirer. Therefore, what does happen? The owner of the changed merchandise, in fact, are both the agent and the original owner. The original owner is entitled to share in the profits, so that he must have become an owner of the changed product that was purchased. What Marova doesn't understand in their question, Mochaku Alaba Marova, is the owner of the grains was presented money. The owner of the money intended for, let us say, wheat to be bought, and yet the agent purchased barley. Who informed the barley owner to transfer ownership of the barley to the investor, the one who provided the money? After all, the one who provided the money was intent on buying wheat, not barley. So as far as Marova is concerned, there's a type of short circuit over here. The transfer of the barley to the one who provided the money is not understandable. What mechanism enabled that to take place? Let us now turn to the Gemara. Mochaku Allah b'Marova. In Eretz Yisrael, they questioned. Le Rebbe Yochanan Aliba de Rebbe Yehuda. According to Rebbe Yochanan, who explained that source number two above, where it said, even though a change took place, the profits are shared. In other words, the owner of the money gets a hold on the changed product, the product that was not that which he ordered. In the case that barley was ordered, and the agent instead purchased wheat, who informed the owner of the wheat to transfer ownership of the wheat to the gentleman that provided the money? That's the question of Marova. Take note of brackets that we have, an angular bracket. This is a very long bracketed section. On the side of the Gemara, we have a starred note that reads, Matras HaSagraim, the purpose of these angular brackets, Matras HaSagraim Elu, Laharois, De'at Soif HaSugya Nishar Kushyas Machku Ala B'Marova. That until the end of this discussion, their question remains. We indicated earlier there was an attempt to raise a question on their question, but that attempt is rejected. So we're going to be left with their question. Let's continue in the Gemara. Maskif lo Rav Shmuel bar Sasrati. Rav Shmuel asks on Ma'arova. If that is what is bothering you, then even when the agency is carried out, afilu chitin v'chitin amilo, you have an agent carrying money to a wheat provider. The wheat provider sees an agent. He doesn't see the owner of the money. And the agent is simply presenting the owner of the wheat with money in exchange for wheat. Who told the wheat owner to transfer ownership of the wheat to the original owner of the money, the original money provider? And yet, that doesn't seem to bother the Ma'arava. Omar Rabbi Avo. Rabbi Avo responds. Notice we have a long marking. Rabbi Avo says, Shiny chitim v'chitim. The case of a person who ordered chitim, provided money for chitim, and money and chitim were purchased, and wheat was purchased, where everything went according to original plan, the shli chisei ka'ovid, v'chi bal bayis domi. There, the agent functions literally as an agent, a shliach, an emissary, an agent of the original owner of the money, and he's like the owner in that sense. He's the extended arm of the owner. That logic applies to an effort that reflected the original plan, where the agent did what he was supposed to do. So he was functioning as an extension of the original owner of the money. So there's no question of how the wheat wholesaler provides the wheat that eventually becomes owned by the investor, the one who put up the money. In simple terms, Rabbi Avo refers to the case of chitim chitim by explaining it as shlichus. Take note that at this point, there's another brackets, the circular type bracket, and it goes down to the end of the original angular bracketed section. What is the purpose in having these brackets? So we look at the double-starred note on the side. Matras Sugraim Elu, the purpose of having these brackets, the Haros de Chuvus Rabbi Avo, the response of Rabbi Avo, Kach Nira Lefinas Daiti, so it appears to me, Lekushis Rav Shmuel Bar Sasrati, Nishar. The answer that Rabbi Avo gives to Rav Shmuel's question is an answer that remains. It's a solid answer. Avol Hemshich Divrei Rabbi Avo, however, the continuation of Rabbi Avo, Lochiach Dvorov Mikotchim, where he tries to prove his point of view from the topic of Kotchim. We're using the term Kotchim in a general sense, where someone sanctifies items. Yeah, Noisei Shel Diyun, that will be the subject of discussion. Kishibahemshich, where we'll see that in the continuation of the Gemara, a little later, Rabbi Avo Maksha Alav. Rabbi Avo will appear, Rabbi Abba will appear in questioning Rabbi Avo's use of Kotchim to prove his point. Ubesoifa Masu Mato Nishar Rabbi Abba Bedaito. At the end of the give and take that we'll see in the Gemara, where you'll notice additional triangles going back and forth, Rabbi Avol will remain with his opinion she'ein lehoichiach ha'hesper shenosan Rabbi Avol shel shlichus, that one should not try to support Rabbi Avol's explanation of shlichus, of agency, midin hamakdish nechosav v'chulei, from the case of one who sanctified his property. So the way I see things is that Rabbi Avo made a point, in one word, shlichus, to explain why, in the case of chitim v'chitim, the owner of the money does gain ownership of the chitim. However, Rabbi Avo's attempt to bolster that from the case of makdish nechosov, that is questionable. And with that introduction in mind, let's go into the Gemara text. There's more to say structurally, with regard to the triangles that we'll get to shortly. Teda, desnan. Teda means you should know that what we're saying is accurate, says Rabbi Avo, that in the case of chitim v'chitim, the way the chitim gets transferred from the wholesaler, the grain, the wheat wholesaler, to the original investor is through shlichus, because we have a Tanaic source that says, Echod hamakdish nechosov, the Echod hamarich es atzmo. Whether you're talking about someone who dedicates his property, his possessions to the Beis HaMikdash, or someone who dedicates his Torah value, ma'arich, is the topic of Erichin for those who are familiar. If not, we don't have to dwell on it here. There's an entire tractate that deals with Erichin. But it has to do with someone that dedicates his Torah prescribed value to the Beis HaMikdash. It's an amount of money. So someone has incurred an obligation, a type of debt or obligation to the Beis HaMikdash. The temple treasurer enters the picture. Ein lo, the temple treasurer who wants to make, we'll say, the collection of this pledge. Ein lo b'ksus ishtov, lo b'ksus bonov. He has no right to take the man's wife's wardrobe, nor the man's children's wardrobe. V'lo b'tseva shetzava lishmon, nor dyes that he prepared for them. V'lo b'sandolim chadoshim shelo kon lishmon, nor from new shoes that he, the pledger, bought for them, for his wife, for his children. V'amai, why do we say that? What enables us to say this point? Lema hachanami, why not say over here, mi hodil latzaba shiaknet sivanisha? Who told the man who makes the dyes that the dyes should be transferred to the woman? In the source we just read, it was quite obvious that the treasurer cannot take the woman's dyes. They're hers. Who transferred ownership of the dyes to her? After all, the husband is the one that purchased the dyes. Elolav mishom damrinon. Rather, the explanation is, we say, dishlichu se ka ovid ukiyat ishto domi. The husband, in buying the dyes for his wife, functioned as an agent on her behalf, and his meeting the dyer was essentially like the extended arm of the woman, of his wife meeting the dyer. He was acting as her agent for purchase of the dyes for her. Let me just repeat this point, and with that in mind, we understand how the dyes got transferred from the dyer to the woman. Hence, the temporal treasurer cannot take those from her, though her husband had dedicated his properties to the Beis HaMikdash. That doesn't entitle the temple treasurer to take her dyes. How did they become her dyes? Because the husband acted as her agent for the purchase of the dyes on her behalf. So too in the case of Chitim v'Chitim, an agent was sent by an investor with cash to buy wheat for that investor. The wheat wholesaler transfers ownership of the wheat to the investor. How? Chinami. Here too, in the case of wheat purchase, shli chusei ka'ovid ukiyad balabayas domi. The agent functions as an extended arm of the owner of the money. At this point, we have come to the end. You notice we had a long answer marking. We've come to the end of Rabbi Avo's presentation. At this point, Rabbi Abba takes issue. The triangle is explained. First, we have a starred note in the margin. Rabbi Abba mara she'en l'Rabbi Avo l'hovi siwa l'dvarav mi'hekdish. Rabbi Abba is going to try to show that Rabbi Avohu should not bring support to his description of chitin v'chitin through shlichus from the case of hekdesh. In our other margin, the triangles are featured. You'll notice we have in the note where the two triangles appear next to each other in two different directions, we indicate ma'akav, an attempt to keep track of a give and take. He'ora, and we want to point out that mishuloshim elu heim hemshech ha-mishuloshim b'liel. These triangles represent a continuation of the of the triangles before. However, Elo demikar labo hadogesh ye al divrei Rabbi Abba lechein shininu oisam, to this kind of triangle. Here the emphasis is going to be on Rabbi Abba, so we've changed the triangle so as to, redirect your mindset. What we're trying to demonstrate here is that Rabbi Abba had made a point. Rabbi Abba is coming to question Rabbi Abba, but not Rabbi Avo's original point of shlichus, but primarily Rabbi Avo's point concerning the support of the idea of shlichus from the case of hektish, from the case specifically where the temple treasurer was not allowed to collect the items that were dedicated to this man's children. We continue in our structural note. The triangle represents Das Rabbi Abba. His opinion is Ein lohavi siwa mehekdish. Don't try to support the concept of shlichus. In our discussion of chitim v'chitim from the case of kochim. The Ein chalois hahekdish talui b'shlichus ela b'deras. For something to become sanctified, it's not dependent on whether there is or there isn't shlichus. It's talui, it's dependent on intent. So that changes the topic. In other words, the case of hektish, why it didn't include the dyes that were provided for the woman and the other items, is talui, is dependent on intent. It's not the fact that the shlichus doesn't take hold is not an outgrowth of the fulfillment of shlichus, of the fulfillment of agency, but rather there's a different explanation for the lack of hektish taking hold on them. An inverted triangle will appear, as you can see there are several in the alternating fashion. Those are nisyonis luchis es Rabbi Abba. Those are attempts to reject Rabbi Abba. So now we turn to the Gemara. Omar Rabbi Abba, loy. He says no. No to that which Rabbi Abba had said, let's bring proof to the shlichus idea as the explanation for chitin v'chitin from the case of makdish nechosov. Why not to bring proof from there? Kol hamakdish nechosov, when the man originally dedicated his property, ein daitai al ksus ishtai uvanov. His mindset, his original intent of dedication did not include his wife's and children's wardrobe and the other items mentioned. So it's not, as far as Rabbi Abba is concerned, the lack of hekdish is not a function of shlichus agency having responsible for their transfer to the woman, but rather the initial sanctification didn't cover those items. Maskifla Rabbi Zera v'chidaita shalodim al tfilov. If you're saying that hektish is dependent on a man's mindset, when a person dedicates his property, does he intend to sanctify his tefillin utnan? Hamakdish nechosav malin loy tefillin. One who sanctifies his property, we subject his tefillin to a financial assessment, and their cash value is to be given to the Beis Hamikdash. Even though the person didn't have his mind that hektish, that sanctity should take hold of his tefillin, Omar le Abaye. Abaye comes to actually strengthen Rabbi Abba. He says, in fact, there is da'as, there is a mindset regarding the tefillin for sanctity. Da'itel shel odom al tefillin. Hamakdish nechosav sover mitzvah ko avidna. When a person dedicates his property, his mind is for this tefillin also to be dedicated. He's figuring that he's doing a mitzvah. It's all part of a big mitzvah of dedicating property, dedicating value to the Beis HaMikdash. And by the same token, a person who dedicates his property does not have his mind on his wife's nor children's wardrobes, because that would involve a feeling of contentiousness, of eva, of strife. So that a person doesn't want to get into bad terms with his wife and children, he doesn't have in mind at the outset for their wardrobes to be dedicated. So at this point, we're strengthening Rabbi Abba's argument that the explanation of the source involving Makdish Nechosov has to do with a person's mindset, not a function of Shlichus, where the original dyer transferred the ownership of the dyes to the wife. Maskif lo Rav Hoshaya. So Rav Hoshaya comes and raises a question. Again, the question is a da'as related issue. V'halo chai ve'erichin shanu kan. Notice we have an arrow. You can align it with the arrow above. And the original source that Rabbi Avol cited, mention was made of someone who dedicates his own Torah value. That's called Chayvei Erechin. Utnan, regarding people who pledge their Torah value, their Torah money value, to the Beis HaMikdash. It says, Chayvei Erechin Mimashkin Son. The temple treasurer has a right to take the individual himself as collateral until he pays up his erichin debt to the Beis HaMikdash fund. V'chidaito shel odam al atzmo l'mashkeno, is a person's mind on himself, that he himself is to be taken as collateral, and yet a person becomes collateral because of his erichin pledge. How does that operate? Is that not a difficulty for Rabbi Avo? For Rabbi Abba? Elo Omar Rabbi Abba. Kol hamakdish nechosov. He who dedicates properties. Nase kemi shehikno lohen ksus ishto uvonov meikoro. When one dedicates his properties, his possessions to the Beis HaMikdash, we view it as if a moment prior to his dedication, he granted exclusive ownership of his wife's and children's wardrobes to them. Hence, it's not part of his property anymore. He's transferred the ownership of their wardrobes to them exclusively. So at that point, the man of the house who's dedicating his properties is fine. He's dedicating all his properties. That doesn't include things that were whose ownership was transferred to the wife and children, they becoming the exclusive owners of those things. Hence, they're not included in the original, in the sanctification that follows. You notice that we had marked Rabbi Abba here with a number 2, because this was a second explanation on the part of Rabbi Abba of how the sanctification of one's nechosav doesn't include ksus ishto, ksus bonov. We started with Rabbi Abba number 1 saying because there's lack of das. In the course of the give and take, we saw that lack of das isn't a sufficient explanation, because we saw in the case of Chayvei Erechin, though there was lack of das, and nevertheless the Hektish authority took over, so to speak, took hold. So how do you then explain the the non-sanctification of Ksus Ishto Vonov in the source above, because of the husband himself, the man of the house himself, transferring ownership of them to the wife and children prior to his dedication, but having nothing to do with the original, let's say, seller of those items, selling it to the Ishto Vonov through Shlichus. That having been said, I just want to review what appears to me to be the main, say, structural element of this discussion. It was the question raised by the Marova, Machaku Alaba Marova, how, in the case of a change, where the agent was sent to buy barley and he bought wheat, according to Rabbi Yehuda, that's called a shinui. And Barova doesn't understand what mechanism enabled the investor to take possession of something he didn't order in the first place. Let us now turn to the Gemara. Before we continue in the text, we have a topic heading on the side called the Nosei. Hakines Sode B'Shem Chaveroi. A person buys a field and he buys it in the name of his friend. He didn't intend for the friend to become the owner of the field, but he presented himself as buying a property, a field, for so-and-so, so as to create a sense of fear on the part of others who might want to challenge the ownership of the property. So I go to an owner of property and I present myself as if I'm buying it in the name of my friend. Apparently the friend is someone that others, that the locals wouldn't want to start up with. The question that will arise in the Gemara is that what are we to do with regard to the bill of sale, the shtar, the document which reflects someone else's ownership other than the one that really bought it? Can we expect a rewriting of a contract somewhere down the road? That will be discussed in the Gemara. The Gemara opens up with a Tanaic source. The Tanaic source that we open up with, it is not expected to be understandable. The Gemara will ask immediately following the framed source, I hope you can see this in the Gemara text, my ka'omar, what are you talking about? What is it saying here? With that question in mind, we glance at the side where a mivneh, structural note, appears. A house shape with a double underline that follows are the house shape represents hesberim, shorav sheshes v'abaye, Labraisa Halekea Sode. Rav Sheshes will appear as number one. The bottom line, you'll see Abaye appearing as number two. They will attempt to explain this vague Tanaic source. The Gemara. Tonu Rabbana. Halekea Sode B'Shem Chaveroi. Ein Kaifin Oisoi Limkor. We can translate, and if it doesn't make any sense, that's good. That's fine. One who buys a field in the name of his friend, we don't force him to sell. V'im omar loy al minas, and if he said on condition that, then we force him to sell. My komar, what is this source saying? Omar Rav Sheshes hachi komar. Rav Sheshes now offers his reading of the source, his understanding of the source. Halokeach sode mei chaveroi b'shem reish galusa. One who buys a field from an owner of a field, and he buys the field in the name of the exilarch, the reish galusa, the head of the Jewish community in exile. We'll refer to that as a as an authority figure, a man of significant power, legal and social power. So you have someone buying a field in the name of the Reish Gelusa. Ein kaifen oisei Reish Gelusa limkar. We do not force the Reish Gelusa to turn around and write up a new document of sale in the name of the one who actually bought it. V'imomar almanas, if the buyer said, on condition that I'm buying this field in the name of the Reish Gelusa, on the condition that the Reish Gelusa rewrites a shtar in my name later. Kaifen es Reish Gelusa limkar. We will force the exilarch to cooperate. Let's look at Rashi. Rashi that we're looking at is toward the last quarter of the page of Rashi commentary. Halokeach soda mechaveru b'shem Reish Gelusa. Shomar lo lamocher. A man says to a seller of a field, Letzerich Reish Gelusa ni locha. I'm buying this field for the Reish Gelusa. V'niskavi latil emo. And the buyer's intent was to cast fear. Shalo yetsu oleo asikin. That challengers should not arise. Challengers, questioners, people that raise doubts of ownership. The kosav hamoicher shtar mechir b'shem Reish Gelusa, and the seller of the field, in fact, wrote a document indicating this field is being sold to the Reish Gelusa. And as we explained, no one's going to start up with that, and the sale will go through smoothly. Rashi goes on, Ein kaifen Reish Gelusa. We don't force the exilarch. Lachser v'lichtov shtar mechira shehu mochro lalokeach. A shtar that would indicate that the Reish Gelusa then is transferring ownership to the real buyer. If the purchaser said to the seller of the field, Almanash yichtov li Reish Gelusa b'shmoi l'shmi shtar acher. I'm buying this field in the name of the Reish Gelusa on condition that he, the Reish Gelusa, writes a new document in my name later on. Oh, if he were to stipulate that, then Kaifen Reish Gelusa Limkor, we will force the exilarch to cooperate and to write a new shtar later that would reflect the Reish Gelusa as selling the property to the real buyer. That's Rav Sheshis' understanding of this Tanaic source. At this point, we're now going to analyze what was said by quoting sections of it and raising questions. The crown shape that you see highlights the resha and the layer, the seifa, the beginning and later the continuation of the source. Let's see if we can understand things. Let's see if Rav Sheshes' explanation holds out till the end. Omar Mar, Halokeach Sada B'Shem Reish Gelusa, Ein Kaifen Oisai Reish Gelusa Limkar. One who bought a field in the name of the Reish Gelusa, we don't force the Reish Gelusa to then rewrite a shtar later on. Michlal, one could infer from here, though, demitne kanyule, that this buyer actually becomes the purchaser of the field, that it's a sale that goes through. The technicalities here of a new star being written later on, that's something we cannot force. But as far as the sale going through, the sale goes through, and the buyer becomes the actual owner of the field. Lema pligo de b'nei ma'arova. Shall we say that this Tanaic source, then, with its inference, serves as a refutation of the b'nei ma'arova that we saw earlier? We have a little arrow, by the way, to the side of the Gemara text, enabling you to see where b'nei ma'arova was referred to earlier. Diamri, what did they say?
V'chimi hodio lebal chitim shiyakne chitim lebal habayis.
In the case of an agent going to a grain provider, and he was given instructions to buy barley, and he didn't do so, but he bought wheat. And we saw above, according to Rabbi Yochanan and his understanding of Rabbi Yehuda, that the wheat gets transferred to the man who provided the money, to the investor. And B'nai Ma'arava didn't understand what mechanism enabled that to take place. After all, the original party didn't order wheat. What are we seeing over here with the purchase of the field and the Reish Galusa story? Here, the Mocher, the seller of the field, heard that the Reish Galusa is purchasing it. The Reish Galusa is the purchaser. So then, how can we infer, or I should say, therefore by inferring that it actually goes to the to what we call the real buyer and not to the Reish Galusa, that would be at odds with the approach taken by the B'nai Ma'arava. Because according to the mindset of the B'nai Ma'arava that we saw earlier, the agent is the one that becomes the owner of the changed grain, the chitin. How could it, in their mind, how could the chitin become transferred to the man who provided the money when he ordered barley? The Gemara says, "E mishum ha lo kasha." If this is what is bothering you, meaning if this is what you are raising as a question against the B'nai Ma'arava, your question, the question being, according to the B'nai Ma'arava, how can the purchaser of the field become the owner of it when the agreement was made that the field was being purchased by the Reish Galusa? We have an answer for that. Kagon de oide labal sode ve'odinhu l'slasadi. Where the real purchaser of the field told the owner of the field the whole story. He told him that I am really buying the field. So that if the question was, how does he, the purchaser, become the owner of the field? Because the one who was selling the field was aware of what was happening. And the story was told to the witnesses as well. So that, as far as I understand this, the fear factor is achieved because in the formal document as provided, the Reish Galusa's name appears. But as far as the transfer of real ownership to the purchaser, that was done with full awareness because the purchaser informed the seller of the field that this is what he was doing. Likewise, witnesses that signed on the document also were aware of this. So the resha of the source doesn't present any difficulty to anything that we've said up till now. Elo emo seifa. However, we are going to have a difficulty in understanding Rav Sheshis' presentation of the seifa. The seifa, the continuation of what Rav Sheshis had reread above. What did it say there? Almanas kaifen oisereish galusa limkar. If the purchaser of the field stipulated, I'm buying this field for myself, you put the Reish Galusa's name in the initial document of sale, on condition that the Reish Galusa, by the way, who's not party to any of this, Reish Galusa is sitting in his chambers in his castle or wherever, he's not part of this whole story. There's a deal being made between a buyer and a seller of a field.
And if the buyer of the field stipulates that I'm buying it on condition that the Reish Galuso later writes a new document in my name, where it will appear that the Reish Galuso is reselling the field to me, the buyer, we will force the Reish Galuso to do so. Well, am I? Why? Velemo Reish Galuso. Let the Reish Galuso, when he's confronted with this, simply say, Lo Yakrai Chuboina Velo Zilusai Chuboina. I don't need your honor. The honor that you're trying to accord me as being a major authority, someone who casts fear on the public, that would be an expression of honor. I don't need that, and I don't need your indignation, meaning having me write a new document as if I, the Reish Galuso, am reselling the field to this purchaser, you're making me into a real estate agent. You're making me into a field seller, a seller of fields. And in all due respect to the profession of being a field seller, that's a few steps down in the social ladder from Reish Galuso status. So I don't need your honor, I don't need your insult. Why in the world would we be able to force the Reish Galuso into rewriting a document just because this buyer stipulated thusly? Elo Omar Abai Hochikoma. So we have to go back to the drawing board. We had an opening source on the second wide line in a frame, and as we said, it didn't make sense. What is the source then saying? So Abaye says, it's saying thusly, Halakeach Sodeh B'Shem Chaveroi. One who buys a field in the name of his friend. We continue at the top of Daf Kuf Gimel. Ein Kaifen Es HaMoicher Limkor Zimno Achriti. We don't force the seller of the field to rewrite a new document later on. If the buyer of the field who bought the field in the name of someone else said, listen, I'm buying it in the name of so-and-so on condition that you, the seller, rewrite a new document in my name later on, we will force him to cooperate. Rashi at the top. We don't force the seller of the field to rewrite a new shtar in the name of the real purchaser. The purchaser should have told the seller, Ksov shtori b'shem Reish Galuso, write my document in the name of the Reish Galuso. Yetsu Asikin Erelem Shushal Reish Galuso. If anyone should come and challenge the sale, I'll show them that it's the Reish Galusas. Uksob li shtar acher b'shmi shelo yavo hayom alumachar yorshe Reish Hagelo l'toyva mimeni. And I want you to write another star in my name, so that in sometime in the future, if there wouldn't be such a document, the members of the Reish Galuso household will come and seek ownership, seek the field, and try to collect it from me. Without that having been stipulated, so as we said, we can't force the mocher to write up a second document in the name of the real owner. At this point, we go over Abaye's explanation by, again, citing the source as he read it. That we're continuing the use of the crown shape, citing the Reisha, and later we've written in between the lines Seifa and applied a crown shape to that as well. Omar Mar, Halokeach Sodeh B'Shem Chavero, Ein Kaifen Es HaMoicher Limkor Zimno Achriti. One who bought a field in the name of his friend. And we saw in the Rashi, the friend referred to as someone that would cast fear on the part of the public, like the Reish Galuso. We don't force the seller to write up a second document in the name of the real buyer. Pshita, that's obvious.
we saw in the Rashi, it wasn't stipulated. So if it wasn't, so why would you think you could force the mocher to write a second shtar? What's the habamina? What is the thinking here that makes this source necessary to be taught? Namely, that it's not so obvious. So we have a long answer. We're explaining here what I would have thought had I not had this din spelled out in the source. Mahu de tema. I might have thought. Motzi omarle, the lokeach, the purchaser, could have argued to the seller. May the yadis, you knew danol enafshoi shakilna, that I was buying the field for myself. Upanche ba'almo hu de koboino, and I was simply trying to save myself. Rashi says upanche ba'almo hu de boino klomar lahatzola, for saving niskavanti. I had, that was my intention. Panche loshen chizek. Panche is an expression meaning strength. So you knew that I was buying it for myself, and I was simply trying to strengthen my position. Vizuzi bichdi lo shadina, and I wouldn't have thrown out my money for nothing. To have a shtar written up with someone else's name in it, and I eventually losing ownership of the field. So you knew all of that. My whole intention was that you would write another shtar with my name in it. So that's what I would have thought that the purchaser could argue. Kamash malon, the Tanaic source reveals to me, it tells us the Omar lay, the seller will be able to argue back in Yono Avdi Loch Behadiahu de Zavnis lay Bishme Vyichtoiv Loch Shtara Achrina. What that means is that you should have made a condition with the one in whose name you bought the field, that he should write up another shtar in your name. Just to refer back to the Rashi that we read earlier, if you were to think that we're going to force the mocher, the seller of the field, to rewrite a second document, that would have had to have been stipulated. Without it being stipulated explicitly, even if the seller of the field was aware of all of these machinations taking place, the seller nevertheless could have argued, what do you want from me? You asked me to write a shtar up in your friend's name who cast fear on the public. If you want a second shtar written up, go to him and he'll write a shtar up for you. The Seifa, in other words, Abaye's understanding of the continuation of that source, said, quote, V'im omar lo amanas, kaifen es hamoichu limkor. If the buyer stipulated with the seller, I'm buying this field in the name of so-and-so tough guy, on condition that you write a second document with my name in it. Then we force the mocher to cooperate. Pshita. Well, is that not obvious? It was stipulated. The Gemara answers that it's not exactly like that. That's not what happened. Not exactly like that. Lo tzricha. It is necessary to be taught, meaning it's not pshita, because it is necessary to be taught under the following circumstances. Do note, by the way, we have a long answer marking. Di omar luhu lesadi kamei didei. The purchaser said to witnesses, in the presence of the seller. Rashi emphasizes here that no explicit condition was made with the seller, but the buyer stated to witnesses in the presence of the seller, Chazu, Dishtora Achrina Koboina, behold, take note that I will need another star. I will need another document. Mahu detema. Now, you might have thought without the source speaking out, without the source telling us explicitly that we will force the buyer, I would have thought motzi omale, the mocher, the seller. I said force the buyer, no, that's a mistake, to force the seller. I would have thought that the seller could have said, amino shtoro meheich de koshatlis bishmei koamris. And when you told the witnesses that you're making this deal, you're buying the field from me, with the intent of having another star prepared, that other star would be prepared by the one in whose name you're buying the field, not from me. Chomash Malon, the source informs us, the Omar Le, the buyer, tells the seller, Lahachi tachi v'amrilu le'edim kamoch, I troubled myself to state my desires to the witnesses in your presence, the minachu de kaboina, because it is from you that I'm going to seek out that second document. Being that the buyer troubled himself to have witnesses present in front of the seller when he expressed his intentions for having another shtar, that is enough for us to then force the seller to rewrite or to write a second bill of sale with the real buyer's name included. Before we conclude, let us remind you that if you wish to be in touch with us in order to access marked Gemaras, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. With that, we conclude our shiur for today.